Peter Wickham has apologized that he's had to go, but he will most likely be back with you on Sunday when Sanker Price takes a look at politics in Barbados in light of the calling of general elections. We still have with us on the line Glenn Murray, and therefore we will have a bit more flexibility now in having some kind of conference call between him and some of the callers that we will have with us during the rest of today's program. Hello, welcome to Down to Brass Tacks.
Yeah, good afternoon, David.
Yes, good afternoon.
Yeah, I have a question for you, but let me deal with Glenn first, because Peter gone, pertaining to manifesto. I heard him say just now that the manifesto is an impetus to a general election. I am going to tell Glenn Murray, and he should recall, because he was involved in politics for a very long time, that since 1961, no manifesto has played an important role in the general election. And let me draw to his attention if he forgets. After 1971 election, it was 1973 that Sir David Simmons became a member of parliament after defeating the candidate that ran for the ruling party.
That was in 1976, earlier 76.
Right, the area where you had the Bernard Maxwell running to financial difficulties.
St. Philip North. Right.
And then Billy Miller before election,
right.
And there was no manifesto, and it was on the straight path of election.
By-election cannot be compared with the manifesto.
But I tell you, it was the beginning. You had to bring the manifesto. It was clear what was happening. All right, well, let me go to 86. Let me go to 86. In 1986, there were no manifesto that caused the people to change. It was the 15,000 that was introduced. Then Dr. Richard Haynes was the leader of the financial opposition, 15,000 that was introduced. Then Dr. Richard Haynes was the leader of the financial opposition leader, the opposition leader on finance. Not the opposition leader, the member who was representing finance in the House of Assembly for the Democratic Labour Party.
Yeah.
And there was no manifesto, and the outburst of Don Blackman, that was not in the manifesto. Nothing so changed in the election.
What evidence do you have that manifestos? You're saying none has ever? What evidence do you have?
I told you it's 1961. No,
you don't.
But that is your opinion. I give in mind. Government is judged on its performance, and the opposition usually wins on accusations that are laid against the government and the way it manages, not no manifesto.
So don't you think that when that same $15,000 tax-free was put in the manifesto. That was included in the manifesto.
But it had already been mentioned in the public domain.
But it was in the manifesto. It was a reference to policies.
But in all fairness, you can have the manifesto influencing some aspects of the manifesto, influencing many people. But there's also the general climate and the perception of the parties, the perception of the leaders, a combination of those things can come into play. And in the absence of doing, a more scientific analysis, then we will always be in a situation where we would just be your subjective opinion versus mine.
I wasn't seeking to imply that the manifesto is the determining factor in an election.
Mm-hmm.
All I'm saying is that in the
it can play a part.
A manifesto
There is a concern I have here, though, that I want to put on the table.
Sure.
We are talking a lot about the economy of Barbados. There is an allegation, for instance, that the latest International Monetary Fund report on Barbados, the Article 4 consultation,
mm-hmm.
has been suppressed by the government of Barbados,
mm-hmm.
because the IMF will not issue this document until and unless the government of Barbados gives approval for it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Now, we talked just now about going to the IMF and the politics associated with it. There are... The politics would also be associated with the timing of the release of a document of this nature, wouldn't it?
Right, that's right.
Where do you stand on this? Is it terribly important that we should know, or is it something that basically we can say in general terms we know what to expect already anyhow, and it doesn't matter? Let me ask Glenn for his view.
Yeah, my view is that it would be useful to know, but people who have been monitoring the situation for the last 5 years and monitoring the central bank figure alternative, if you monitor even the previous IMF report, you must know, given what is prevailing, Barbara, that it has to be along the same line. It cannot be anything spectacularly different. It can't be since an improvement. It has to be more of the same thing.
More of the same. And the very fact that you hold on to it would give the impression that it's bad news.
But you remember Erskine Stanley from 1991, when Henry Ford had made reference to, I think it was an IMF report, and it was pilloried for it. And then when
he said the economy was battling like sobers in 1989.
And he said, he also said that he knew what he had to do, but he was not about to commit political suicide. So I can only surmise that the government, if it is suppressing, is doing it because they probably they will see that tantamount to committing political suicide as well. But again, that is where the strength of leadership of a government obtains.
The strength of leadership of government, but at the same time, we have to recognize the weakness of politicians.
Yeah, because like I said earlier, they try to do things, especially at election time, that will give them an advantage rather than disadvantage.
Yes.
Okay. I don't know if the caller wants to put his two cents.
Yeah, I want to say something on that.
Yeah.
Yeah, David, it is strange that we in 2018 and 2017 could be seeing the IMF like an Indian on a horse coming with arrows or something pointing at it. And we had some of the greatest prime ministers of this country, the late Tom Adams, went into the IMF, Sandy went into the IMF. But all of a sudden, it is all because of the party that managing, who does not know what to do, has put, we've found ourselves in a position where people seeing the IMF as so bad, and all the IMF is there is like a bank. Take all of your debts and put it into one and make it easier for you to live. And if the government didn't know what they're doing, they would have already gone to the IMF, and nobody wouldn't be in a problem worrying about the IMF today. And we would have saved ourselves.
That's an interesting. It's an interesting angle to it, and I think, Glenn, this is the angle. There are a lot of people in Barbados who, when you look at the track record of the government in handling the economy, would question the degree of success that we've had.
Right.
So, if the government, the DLP now looks towards the future and says, you can take the devaluation off the table, but we are indeed of the view that a relationship with the IMF is necessary. Rather than giving the impression, once you take the valuation out, which is a big, elephant in the room, the thing that scares people most of all, is there a possibility that it could inspire people?
But to take the IMF out, you will have
The valuation.
To take the value off the table, mm-hmm. you would have to have done a number of things that would not make that no longer necessary or feasible.
Well, but you establish your political objectives, and you say quite clearly, in the same way that Mr. Arthur established the political objective of the 30,000 jobs, and what? He didn't say that he was kicking the IMF people out of Barbados as well?
No, that was the first thing he did next morning.
Right. So,
except that the IMF would call for what they term conditionalities.
Yes.
And it is argued that even though the IMF has changed its way, it's not as harsh and draconian as before, timing is also important. The earlier you go, the easier set of conditions you have to meet.
Because Greece has been in a vortex for 7 years now.
That's right. Yeah. Because the Greeks were false defense figures and bamboos of the European Union and had everybody in a mess.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right.
But therefore, when Tom Adams went in what was 81? Yeah. 81, I think it was. He had already begun to take some of the measures which the IMF would have required. And therefore, by the time he got there, it was a walk in the park. There was no harsh, there was no layoffs, no things like in Barbados like that.
Well, by that time, what we had, or at that time, we had a standby arrangement with the International Monetary Fund, which wasn't seen as harsh and draconian.
Structural adjustment program.
Yeah.
That's because you went early enough to that a standby arrangement would do the job right away. When they say a basket case, if you go with what they said, a basket case, then therefore we can only expect the harshest terms because your condition is they going into, you know, going into surgery. All depends on how severe your condition is.
Down to brass tacks, let's take another call. Hello? Welcome to the program. Yes.
Yeah, good afternoon, David.
Hi.
Yeah, good afternoon. I wanted to make 2 points. First, I want to find out from Mr. Kelman how comfortable he is with saying that the Prime Minister has his own ideas and his own mind in terms of dealing with a country of almost 300,000 people who he's supposed to be representing, and saying to Peter Wickham, look, you always have an opposing view to the Prime Minister, but at the end of the day, the Prime Minister do what he feels like doing. You're a member of a cabinet. You have a leader who does what he feels like doing. How could your representatives think that you're having any decent input, or they may look at you as just a little yard boy or tag along in terms of not making any serious impression on their behalf? And I say that to say that I heard Mr. Maurice saying, for instance, that strategy is subjective, which may be true. But at the same time, he still alluded to the importance of it. And if you are supposed to be influencing a whole set of people, you want to win them over, and you have started at a disadvantage with a lot of odds against you, as, you know, repeating, people do know that the country under the leadership of the DLP has fundamental challenges in terms of how they have treated to the economy, how they've treated to the taxes of the people, how they've treated the unemployment, and the list goes on. So if you want to come now and win the people over, your strategy should be one that people can say, look, you know something? This gentleman really has the people's interest at heart.
So would he have to do to win the people's hearts against that background?
Well, I'm not here.
What could he tell you to make a difference to you? Let's bring this down to you.
Right. What I would have said in terms of as a person, as a Barbadian looking for hope, I would have think that the Prime Minister would have been in a position to say, look, we are not selling any of the country's assets, because this is what we are going to do in terms of, for instance, with the transport board. This is what we are going to do in terms of the oil company. This is what we are doing in terms of unemployment. This is what we are doing in terms of education. This is what we are doing in terms of the road project that was supposed to be such a fantastic one. There's so much money involved that never come to...
But when you're the incumbent, don't you have a big problem in telling people what you are going to do? Because that has to be matched against what you have been able to do so far, especially when you've been in power for 10 years. How do you see it, Glenn Murray?
I say that he was talking about the need for the Prime Minister to have an effective communication strategy again. The government want to argue that they have done all, they're still saying, you know, references are still being made to the international recession. Right? The worst ever, et cetera.
Is that valid, though?
I don't know if it's valid, but references, I'm still hearing references. And then they're also saying that in the context then of that they have not done badly, because there have been no further layoffs, there's been no devaluation, you haven't got, you know, and those guys, and the hospitals are still working, people are still going to school, people are still getting paid, pensions still get their money, and that's what they consider. In those terms, we have not done that badly.
But that is if that well, in all circumstances, if you can say people are still going to work and stuff. However, it is not difficult to establish beyond a shadow of a doubt that the international recession ended. Because that's a statement of fact.
Yeah, David, can I say something here?
Mr. Marie, I want to know how you would buy that argument.
Which one? Yes. He wants to know how you would respond to that.
Can I report to him?
What I want to say to Mr. Marie is, people are still going to work, right? But what about people's dollar not being devalued in terms of the IMF, but that your dollar that used to be a dollar is now valued to you 40 cents? How do you look at that, you got to look at people going to work, but they're not, ends are not meeting.
Yeah.
And also, we still have to be realistic and see that people have a big challenge trying to make it in terms of renting, in terms of buying food. The government promised people a look into food and the prices, and it never came to anything, and it gone sky high in inflation is extremely high in Barbados. So even the gasoline, that is continuing to go up and down like a seesaw, but it's getting worse all the time, and diesel. And all the commodities that people need in a day-to-day life, medicals, everything is gone up. How would you say that somebody
suppose the government goes further and says, sure, we know things are tough. We've had to make it tough through taxation and whatnot. But stick with us. This country has not grown to halt. It's not a failed country. Stick with us. We promise to make it better. Have faith.
The businesses surrendering and crashing every day. So it's project people shutting their businesses. A country has to come to a halt. Any different? Come on, man.
I'm just trying to present you what could be an argument on their part.
Yeah, you don't think there's any more worse halt you could want. That one is for the last 6 weeks, actually.
Interesting discussion. Down to brass tacks. You're on the air, and I have with me Glenn Murray, who's on the line as well. Hello?
Mr. Ellis.
Yes.
How are you, sir?
I'm well, and you?
And, of course, Mr. Murray. I'm glad that he's on the line. Now, Mr. Ellis, two issues you want to review today. We have the issue of the seaweed again, sargassum seaweed flooding North Shores and blocking the shores, and businesses and so on, of course, cannot make use of the facilities. And even although we have to admit that there are certain aspects of we cannot prevent, we also have to admit that if we remove the moss in a timely fashion, that it would not have time to pile up to 3 and 4 feet, and then it starts to smell and makes the water slimy and create insects and so on. Do you know of any policy decision by the Barbados Tourism Authority or the Barbados Hotel and Tourism Authority which claim the beach as their asset, where they have a plan in place to get some bobcats or some cascabeles or something to push the moss from the beach beyond the high water mark so it doesn't have time to pile up on the beach? Do you know of any plan for this? Because as far as I'm concerned, this is about the eighth year we've had this. And you have the Barbados Tourism Authority, you have the Barbados Hotel and Tourism Authority, you have the Department of Emergency Management, and I believe the NCC, they could collaborate with the NCC and have a plan on there that when the moss starts to come, within 3 days you start to push it off the beach. So it doesn't pile up. Do you have any idea what is happening with this, Ms. Ellis?
No, but I note with a great degree of interest that you believe that the primary responsibility rests with the private sector, as distinct from the NCC, which, as I understand it, has had responsibility for looking after our beaches over the years. So I want to find out from you, why is it that if indeed you are shifting the responsibility a bit more to the private sector, why are you doing that?
Because the moss is an emergency situation. It's just like a hurricane or high tide or like a hurricane or a tsunami like that. You have to bring different aspects of human administration together, because the NCC alone cannot handle this.
Yes.
The NCC may have a few trucks and so on. But
excuse me.
But this, there's a cost involved here. And I believe if the government gives the Ministry of Tourism $96 million, that is a tremendous sum of money, way and above what the NCC gets. I think it's the responsibility of the NCC, the Barbados Tourism Authority, and the hotels which are affected by this situation, to sit down with the NCC and say, let us see how we can assist.
Okay,
in
look,
this.
In principle, I don't disagree with you that there's need for a joint effort on it.
Mm.
While you talk about the money that is given to the tourism sector, people can also point to the amount of money that the taxpayers have been given the government of Barbados to run the affairs of this country over the years. And that, and to that extent, while there is a shared responsibility, many would suggest to you that the the primary responsibility rests with the government agencies that have that particular task. But I don't know of any plan as you have outlined it. And I do know that there has been a resurgence of sargassum seaweed, and it has been creating problems in places like St. Philip, for instance.
I also believe that because of the seriousness of this, the environmental challenge that it poses, that the parliamentary representatives for those areas, River Bay, Martins Bay, Consett Bay, Long Beach, although the political representatives should take an interest in it and make sure that something is done. They cannot do anything by themselves, but they can engage the attention. This is a problem we have in Barbados, where government agencies don't seem to be able to sit down and discuss matters of common interest and decide how they're going to approach it. And they keep pointing fingers at each other.
I'm glad that you mentioned that, because I've heard other people talk about that as a problem Barbados is facing. It's at the core of why we have this implementation deficit. And
it is
a matter that needs to be addressed if we are going to fix some of the other issues. Certainly if we entered a program of discipline, and that discipline doesn't have to be imposed on us by somebody or some agency from abroad. But we ourselves must recognize where Barbados is as a country and what is required right here and now. And the civil service, wherever we are having these obstacles here, where it appears as though even if the left hand knows what the right hand is doing, the two of them are not moving in unison, that needs to be addressed. On whom will you depend? Now, Glenmurray has spent a lot of years as a journalist, and then he worked in government as a minister. And Glenda, you came into direct contact with the issues facing the private sector, the public sector, when it comes to working together. I don't know what it was then, but if it has worsened, what are your thoughts on how we could perhaps try to address this?
You mean you're talking to me?
I was speaking to Glenn Murray, if he's still
there. Oh. But let me just say what Murray is thinking about it. Department of Emergency Management has the mandate to get all those departments together and to formulate a policy to deal with this, because it is an emergency situation. Isn't anything that can build into a budget itself? We're going to get moss next year, because I don't know. It is my view that this moss is a direct result of chemical pollution of the sea floor in the Caribbean. Because I lived in Barbados, I rose up on the reservoir on the East Coast. And the first time I saw this moss emerging was after they had that oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, where they had to treat it with chemicals. And since then, every year we've been getting this moss.
But you know that you have not provided me with proof of why you have come to the conclusion that you have.
Because I never saw it before.
But that cannot be the only reason that you will advance for that. That doesn't make sense to me, because you haven't seen it before.
All right, wait a minute. You ever look at the map, look at the Gulf of Mexico, and you see...
Well, you're a fascinating guy, you know.
No,
just stick your neck out.
Just a minute. If you look at the Gulf of Mexico on your map, you'll see that it embraces several South American states, including Texas. That is where the moss started, right in that Gulf where you walk. That Gulf was affected with the oil spill, and then the tree, the oil spill, the chemicals, that is the first place the moss started out there. No, it didn't start here. It started right in the Gulf of Mexico. And if you look at the map, you'll see the Gulf of Mexico opens right onto the Caribbean Sea. So I'm not a madman. I have looked at this myself and researched it. That is where the moss started, right in the Gulf of Mexico, all the southern United States there. That's where the moss started. And 2 years after it started there, it started coming down in the Caribbean.
You know,
and that's how we know.
Somebody,
there's a direct relationship.
Somebody has written here to say this to you.
Mm.
They say that you see the seaweed as a disaster. You do?
Mm.
Do you?
I don't see it as a disaster.
What do you see it as?
I see the seaweed as a phenomenon that we have to deal with before it creates a disaster.
Before it creates a disaster.
That's right.
They say by the same token, though, you continuously play down the effect of the sewage disaster on the South Coast.
But I'm not dealing with that.
No. You're not dealing with it today. But they have listened to you.
Yeah.
And over the time that they've been listening to you, they see a blatant contradiction. They say that this problem on the South Coast is as much or perhaps is more of an issue.
Mm.
And you ignore it. You play it down.
No. The sewage system on the South Coast, I've spoken about that already. And I've also said that this problem on the South Coast is one that had a design fault, which was not prepared, which was not designed to handle 8 million gallons of sewage, and therefore you're going to get those consistent. But I am aware that it's unpleasant. I won't want to be living around there either. But the fact is that you have a design fault that you cannot fix with just patch here and patch there and patch. I have said the best way to deal with that, and I've said this about three times, is to dig some suck wells. 8 or 10 suck wells somewhere in the area, not all together, and just run off the excess sewage into the suck wells. That's what we used to do before we had the plant. Use suck wells to receive the sewage, a 40 or 50 foot suck well, but deliver the sewage onto the limestone there, which will filter it back down into the aquifer. I don't like what they're doing now with these deep wells. That's foolishness. Trying to dig a well down to 150 feet, you are liable to encounter the aquifer. The aquifer usually starts about that deep, that's that. But if you put it 40 or 50 feet up and it filters through the limestone, then it goes in the aquifer as pure water. But what they're doing with these deep thing wells is very, very dangerous. And that's all you have to say about that. There's another matter I want to say, want to talk about, sir. It is, we are talking about the economy. I feel, sir, that our economy is being sabotaged or has been sabotaged, mainly by the private sector. And I'll tell you why I say that, sir. The private sector sold off their prime economic assets and put the money in the bank. They ain't getting nothing on that. They come back and let the plantation land that is supposed to produce food crops and animals and so on run into grass. So what is happening now is that we have to increase our food import bill, and that affects our foreign exchange account. The private sector, on the other hand, in addition to that, they owe the Treasury over $500 million in taxes that they won't pay. And I see these things, sir, as attempts. Not only that, we have had at least 6 projects that came to our shores, including Cahill. Cahill is one of the most advanced part that ever came to our shores, and one of the most helpful too. Cahill, Merrickton, St. Philip, the Pickering's project, the St. Andrews project, the Andrews Sugar Factory project, the Hyatt project, all these are foreign exchange and projects that came to our doorsteps. And we have found different ways to get rid of them. We kick Cahill down the street, gone. $600 million. What we have done, in effect, is we have barred over $2 billion in investment coming to Barbados.
Who kicked Cahill down? There's an echo going through this broadcast all the time. Somebody just complained about it, and I heard it from very early. Yes, tell me, who kicked Cahill out and down?
Down and out? The first people here on Cahill's case was the opposition. The opposition spent two successive years of debate in the House to knock Cahill and Sandals. But they get rid of Cahill, but then get rid of Sandals. Thank God for that.
How did they manage to get rid of Cahill?
Well, they criticized it. They criticized the project. They said they had been to other places and the project had failed and all that kind of thing. And Bajans bought into it. In actual fact, the Cahill project was really abandoned because there were local people who felt that Cahill was going to come here and take money out of their pockets. So they blocked it in the hope that the money would fall into their pockets again. People who feel that every door, they must knock at every door and fill their pockets with money and wants this government project. But that's another part for another thing.
I thought that this thing fell apart when a plasma gasification plant in Scotland or some part of Britain ran into trouble. And it tended to cement the concerns which were being raised by some people about bringing a technology such as that to Barbados when there was still a lot of doubt and questions about it. That was my recollection of what really caused the government to have reservations about that. But
Mr. Ellis, let me tell you something.
I don't recall it being abandoned exclusively because of the criticisms that were directed at it, not only by the opposition, I may say, but by many other people as well, because there were town meetings that the people who wanted to mount the project held.
But you may know, Mr. Ellis, you see this plasma gasification? That fooled a lot of people in Barbados because some of us went to school, but we didn't learn nothing. We have employed plasma gasification technology in the sugarcane industry for years. Well, every sugar factory used plasma gasification technology. Every single one. If you check with any engineer, they'll tell you the same thing. The gasification is just turning a liquid into steam, and the plasma is the fuel you use to create the heat, to produce this. That's all it is. It sounds like a big word, but ain't nothing. All those sugar factories use plasma gasification.
Yeah.
So if there was any problem.
I understand where you're going with that, but as far as I'm told, it is a bit more complex than equating it to the sugar factory in Barbados. In any case, we got to leave you now. Thank you.